Welcome to Creative Block. Today, I am your host, V. On Creative Block, we interview people in creative industries about their life, work, and hobbies while we doodle jam. We ask people on our social medias if they have specific topics they wanted us to discuss, as well as some drawing prompts. And today, we have Drew Green. Hi.
Hello. It's me, Drew.
is. I'm so excited for you to be here because I feel like I've followed you online for a really long time, but we haven't gotten the chance to work together yet, so this is really fun.
It's a small world, but it's not small enough.
We have a ton of questions from our listeners, and I like that they're a little bit in chronological-ish order. So I think I'm gonna get right into it.
Sure, yeah.
Thanks to our listener from YouTube at NothlitKC L5734. Do you remember your earliest drawing and what was it?
Oh my gosh. I don't remember my earliest drawing. I was drawing since I was probably about 3 years old. I was really young, but I remember drawing a lot of things from like video game instruction manuals. So I drew a lot of like Mario characters and Mega Man characters. I'm 35, so I'm like the NES was still a thing when I was a kid.
Yeah, we're like the same age. Are you 89 as well?
89. Yeah, my birthday was January 6th, the cursed day.
Happy birthday,
Thanks.
though.
I'm
So wait, are you Sagittarius? No, Capricorn or
Capricorn. Capricorn, yeah.
yeah, I love the zodiac. We don't have to get like really deep
No,
into
that's fine.
it, but
I mean, I'm not super invested, but it sure is fun. But yeah, I'm a Capricorn, so I'm emotionally withdrawn and I know everything.
but you work a lot.
I do. That's very true.
So yeah, you're talking about like mostly just like from Nintendo manuals. Yeah, like those drawings are just so appealing.
I know. What a place to learn from, right?
Do you feel like you were mostly copying or were you like drawing from imagination or a mix of both?
It always started with copying, but like I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with the Koopalings. I'm still obsessed with them to this day. They're like seven, now eight, perfect character designs. And I remember drawing them from the manuals, copying, but then like, drawing my own fan art before we really had like a term for that when I was, a kid. Yeah, I mean, I remember making up a lot of Mega Man bad guys too. Like that was a big thing for me, especially Mega Man X, because the bad guys were usually animal, like something animal. And I'm like, yeah, I'll have like, I don't know, magma. I'm looking around my office. What's an animal? Magma sea lion. I don't know. It was kind of that thing. Yeah. So my imagination was doing some of the work too.
Nice. Yeah, it's kind of like yeah, I think that's where Pokemon is so smart. Like when you're saying like magma sea lion, that feels like that's a
Yeah, I
Pokemon.
mean, certainly when I was around that age, like 10, 11, I was drawing a lot of Pokemon, a lot of Digimon, making up my own, pretending I was like a Pokemon trainer. I mean, this is probably par for the course for the
Yeah.
people listening. But yeah.
Well, so I'm just gonna give a quick shout out to Figment, I think, who so I guess that's pretty much when you realize that you love drawing, right?
Like I just, so I come from a really poor family. We didn't have a lot, we scraped by and things were tough and drawing was my escape. So, yeah, drawing was always really important to me and I'm glad I have it. It's a good thing to be able to do. It's a good thing to be able to make your own escape and your own sort of sanctuary in your head,
Yeah, I agree. I feel like that's very relatable. I feel like also when I was like a kid and like we didn't we didn't really have like a ton of things to kind of take a hold of our attention like nowadays, I guess. So when you were bored, at least like with a piece of paper and a pen, you could just like be very entertained.
No, for sure.
Did you go to art school?
No, I didn't. I'm actually a high school graduate.
Oh, that's so cool. I love getting these stories. Heck yeah. Oh, let's get into it.
I didn't go to school. Sometimes I wish I did. I certainly don't regret the lack of college debt. I definitely I wish that I had the I wish I had some of the experiences my peers had, but I've landed in a pretty good place, and yeah, I'm proud of
Can
that.
you tell us a little bit about how you, so when you graduated from high school, what was your pl like what was your plan? Did you get a job, and did you want to like with your long-term goal getting in the animation industry, or what was that?
For the longest time, I thought I would end up in comics. And I did some comics work, and I had, I had a web comic, who didn't in 2009. But I don't know. I didn't initially see myself going into animation. I just never really thought about it. But as I started to get into my sort of early mid-20s, I was like seeing my friends move to California, seeing people enjoy success in animation and doing something with their lives. And I got sort of tired of scraping by on commissions and the odd comics work here and there, and just decided it was, time to pack up and move to California and hope it worked out. I also have to say, like, I've always been able to enjoy animation and be critical about it, but still enjoy it. The way that I find I'm not as good at sort of turning my brain off and enjoying it for what it is with other mediums. So yeah, I just knew that it was going to be a good fit.
Oh, that's awesome. I want to get into that a little bit more later, but I also want to ask you, where are you from originally? Like, where did you move from?
I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, because there's a little bit of an animation industry there as well. But it's kind of small, right?
Yeah, I mean, even at the time it was there was, but it was a lot of like adult primetime stuff, which now I have some experience in, but at the time I didn't. And yeah, I just knew that I wanted to come out here and work in kids media. That's where my love for cartoons generally lies. So yeah, I never ended up actually working in animation when I was in Atlanta. I did try, I mean, back then I wanted to work in design. I would end up ultimately becoming a board artist when I came out here, and I think that was the best transference of my skills in comics. But everybody thinks that they want to like go and design like the next Gem Fusion or whatever, And it's like design is incredible, but it's not always glamorous. So, you get into it and you're like, oh, right, I have to draw a crowd that looks good instead of like a blob. And as a board artist, I get to draw a blob, and I think I prefer that. Anyway, yeah, I didn't work in animation in Atlanta, but I am from Atlanta.
That's really cool. I kind of want to ask a little bit to how that process was like for you when you made the decision to really try to get into the industry. Like, did you have any like a specific strategy, or were you just kind of like going with the flow? What was it like when you really decided to try to get in the industry?
So it's funny. I, in preparation for the idea that I wanted to move to California, I came to Burbank for the first time for what's that called? CTN. It was, I think it was 2014. I'm a little iffy on the times. I think it was 2014. It's my first time here, and I was super nervous, and I had my portfolio, and I was walking around feeling really self-conscious. But the more I showed my portfolio to people, the more they knew who I was already. And
Oh, that's
yeah, which is a nice ego boost. Sometimes it's kind of all you need. But I kind of left that experience feeling like, okay, I can come here, I can come here and I can be social, and I can put my face forward. And that's ultimately what I did. I decided that 6 months later I would move here, and I came here and I had a lot of lunches. Mm. And I met a lot of really nice people, and yeah, I don't know. It's not a very complicated story, but yeah, sorry. I think I've gone off the rails with the question.
No, I think that's really great because you're talking about getting lunches, and would you get lunches with other peers, like other artists, or were you in contact with recruiters? Like, who were you talking to?
Both. I remember having lunches with people. I never went into lunches thinking, oh, this is going to be a job. Mm-hmm. Like, I always went into it knowing that in order to enjoy, this is going to sound two-faced, but to enjoy success out here, you have to be able to befriend people. And mm-hmm. I always went into it thinking, these are people that I really respect and admire, and I want to meet them and I want to pick their brains. And certainly there were lunches with recruiters as well. I was lucky to have a lot of contacts coming in from people who were already in the industry. But yeah, it was as simple as like asking artists that I admired if they had, you know, if they had a spare hour, mm-hmm. and learning a lot that way. It was always helpful.
Nice. Would you go in the lunches with a lot of questions, like work-related questions?
Yeah, I would. But I would say it was more important for me to get to know
them as a person.
Them as a person and the human side of what they do. Mm. I never went in wanting a specific answer or hoping for a specific answer to any questions I had. I always wanted to know how the job made them feel.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I wanted that. I wanted to know how the job made them feel. And I wanted to know how to best make myself useful on a job. Mm. Yeah, that's kind of usually where I focused my attention when I would ask for advice. And I think that worked to my advantage. This job, this line of work, it's very human. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a creative person, which means like you're always going to have to tap into your humanity to make that work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was always my focus.
That's great. I really love that answer and the way you spelled it out. I mean, that's a great way also to bring a little bit of an answer of like how to network, right? Because it's always like so difficult to know how to do that.
Yeah, for sure. It is. I you know, and I have people now, and particularly as I started getting into the industry, who always seem so intent on like getting the magic answers and sometimes being a little too eager to like get straight to talk about what I do and not like who I am as a person. Mm. And I get it, like we're all, you know, hungry and eager, and that's fine, but I always respond better when somebody like talks to me about the human side of what I do, and I try to do the same when I talk to other people. So yeah.
Yeah.
Just tap into your own humanity, because it will always serve you. It'll always serve you well.
That's great.
I don't know what this like Pearl Mario situation is, but this is what I'm doing.
I love it.
he's beautiful.
He really is, man. That like that is actually a great design. I'm like,
he looks so angry.
I'm struggling so hard to kind of like draw like some of these prompts this morning for some reason. I'm like trying to draw this like Pearl Splatoon, and I've never played the game. So I'm like, you know what? I'll just try to see what I can do with the reference.
I think you're doing great. Honestly, I think it's great.
Oh, thank you. I kind of wanted to keep digging a little bit into that theme. And I'm going to give a quick shout out to Lourdes Marshall on YouTube, who asks, how difficult was it to get in the industry as a beginner artist? Like, so how would you gauge how hard it was to get in?
You know, I sort of got lucky, which I bet is something a lot of your guests say. Mm-hmm. Because everybody's story is different. I think for me, ultimately, none of those lunches are what provided me, quote unquote, provided me with a job. I had already been in touch with Kyle Carroza, who created Mighty Magiswords. And he had expressed interest in me when I mentioned I was moving to LA, and we did have a lunch, so I guess I just lied to you on accident. But I mean, you know, that's just me trying to like make my presence known, like I'm here. Yeah. Let's grab food. But It took me about 4 months, and that's just because he was waiting for a while for an answer from Cartoon Network about mm-hmm. whether or not he had a show. And so my situation is a little different, and it'll be different for everybody.
I like to just kind of get into nitty-gritty of the details of like how the first your first job in the industry happened. So it sounds like it was on Mighty Magic Swords, right?
Yeah, it was. And I think it was just one of those things where making comics was the reason why I was able to make a case for myself as a board artist.
Nice.
And I went straight into boarding. I didn't do any revisions. I didn't start as a revisionist, which I do think was a mistake.
Oh yeah, why?
Yeah, I was very green. I picked up a lot of bad habits by kind of learning by doing without like some of the guidance that I think revisions would have helped me learn. And I took a long time to break those habits.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because it sounded like, can you tell us a little bit about the Magisword production? Because it, from what I've heard, it sounded like it was pretty, pretty loose in terms of like boards. Would you say that?
Yeah, it was. We were working with outlines, but we were free to rewrite them as needed, and they were pretty loose anyway, you know, and we had a lot of content but very little time to make it happen. So it was kind of just like, it was a little stressful. Most of us were pretty new, and so we were all sort of boarding 2 episodes worth of material for every 1 episode, and we just see a lot get cut. It was loose but hectic at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it was for a lot of people, it was everybody's first time, right? Like, it was Kyle's first time show running, and it was like, for a lot of people, it was like their first boarding job, would you say? So you were all kind of like figuring it out together.
Yeah, not all of us, but most of us. It was our first boarding job, and it was Kyle's first time running a show. You know, he had experience elsewhere before, but not as a showrunner. And that job is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, I try to give people generally the benefit of the doubt now. I wasn't as good about that back then, but I think I try to have sympathy for the fact that everybody's job is really hard.
Yeah, that's so true. I feel like every step of the production, and it's like, you never really understand the full scope of a position until you step in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a strange one to learn how to do the job. It was a strange one because it was just, we were making it in ways that you don't really see a lot. A lot of it was, I mean, I was there. It initially started as a series of shorts, which were all animated in-house.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And we still had our animation team, from what I remember, I hope this is true. I'm pretty sure it's true. We still had our animation team in-house working on a lot of stuff. I think they were doing a lot of retakes. Mm. They were probably just straight up doing a lot of the more important shots and stuff. I maybe don't quote me on that, but I feel like that was the situation. But yeah, we were just unlike anything else that was being made at Cartoon Network. And we were an interactive show. We were initially sort of an online thing. So yeah, I don't know. It was just like, it was just very different. It was very different. It was a very unusual tone. It was very different from everything Cartoon Network was producing at the time. They were doing a lot of like Steven Universe, eventually Craig of the Creek, a regular show. We were Looney Tunes meets anime. It was, you know, it was just, it was a lot to adjust to. I think fondly of that time. I do. But yeah, it was an uphill battle for a lot of us. We were all learning on the spot. It was tricky.
Yeah, and especially because what you're talking about, like Looney Tunes anime, I feel like is something that is very appealing, especially like that's the kind of like blend that I feel does super well online. But it is hard to describe and to kind of have a full crew fit into. I think it's just such a specific blend of styles.
Yeah. You know, I think, again, this is a charitable take, like, or not even charitable. This is coming from kindness. This is not a read. This is not a criticism. But I think with a lot of showrunners, and this has been true of almost every job I've worked, sometimes the vision is very clear in their head, and, you know, communication skills can be all over the place. But regardless of that, it can be really hard to guide the people who are helping you make the thing to do it in the way that you see mm-hmm. it, you know, and Kyle, he's the kind of guy who can just like, you know, just bang out a drawing of what he wants, what he sees, and it looks exactly how he wants it to look. And I really respect that. But, you know, we were all sort of learning mm-hmm. to fit to that to some degree. I mean, it was a flash show. So we did have some leeway in terms of like some wiggle room in terms of being on model, but we still wanted to like match the energy of it. And mm-hmm. I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like that mixture of those two sort of very different styles and feelings and tones, there was an adjustment period for sure.
Yeah. 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 That's so, yeah, that's really yeah. fun. So how long were you on the show total?
I was on the show for its whole run as a series. So that was, I boarded on it for about 2 years, I think. We were two seasons, and I think that was about 2 years.
Yeah, man. Back in the days when we had a job for 2 years.
I know. I haven't had a job that long since that job, which is really unfortunate.
That's so crazy. Yeah, it's crazy when we think about it, because that was not that long ago. Like, when was, what year were you on Magisword? Was it like...
Let's see. I've been here for I've been here almost 9 years. Mm-hmm. It'll be 9 years in June. Let's see. That was 2015, I think.
Yeah.
When I started. Yeah. Which is wild to think.
Yeah. It's funny because we got in LA approximately at the same time. I got here in 2016. Yeah. So
I
remember the show was in production. So when Magisword wrapped up, can you talk a little bit about like what that was like emotionally, but also like finding a new job and all of that?
Yeah. One of the things that I loved so much about working in studio, which is a little harder to come by now, is that I always had the opportunity to talk to people in other productions and not just my own. And so I had a lot of friends in other shows, on other shows, and I made sure to go and say hi when we had time and get cereal from the cereal bar or whatever, or candy from the candy mm-hmm. machine. So really healthy. and hang out. And I actually ended up sort of making my case for a job on Crag of the Creek for a little bit after Magiswords. I was boarding on the finale for Magiswords at the same time as I was doing the sort of rough pass for my first Crag episode. And I was technically considered freelance. But yeah, I don't know. I networked a lot. It's weird. At home, outside of work, I'm kind of a homebody. I'm kind of, you know, quiet and to myself, but at work I come alive. And so yeah, I just, you know, made sure I got in front of the right people and had meetings and made a good impression. And I, you know, this is back when testing was a lot more common. Mm-hmm. So I did a really good test for Craig, and they wanted me to come on for a couple episodes. So there wasn't a break between Magiswords and Craig for me, but it definitely was sad, you know, anytime you finish and you've been basically a family on some mm-hmm. level. I mean, I hate that term because it implies that we should, you know, kill ourselves to make the job, or overwork ourselves to make the job mm-hmm. work, I should say. But, you know, you're really close with your crewmates. It's always sad. Even if it's just like a few months, there's always that little empty feeling inside. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was sad. I remember going into my office that I shared with Zoe Moss, who was my board partner for a good portion of the show. And it just smelled like hot plastic because the sun had been baking this nearly empty office, but I had to get something from it. And I was like, well, this is it. Yeah. It's just a weird little moment. Although I'm a few parts melancholy sometimes. So I just sort of like to bask in that feeling of like, it's over.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like kind of appreciating the emotion, even if it's not like a completely positive emotion. It's like,
yeah. Like, if it's not a little bit sad, was it worth it?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's healthy, but that is how I feel at the end of most jobs. There are some jobs where I was happy to finish up and be done. But yeah, like, I will always have love for my time at Magiswords, even though it was pretty hectic sometimes. it was my first job in the industry, and it was, I got to work at Cartoon Network, and that's where I really wanted to work. I got very lucky.
Yeah, that's really,
yeah.
That's a great story, because I feel like the first jobs are always so special because you're learning so much. I feel like there's so much to learn, and you keep learning in the next jobs. But I feel like the first job is the one where you really just like have to hit the ground running and just learn everything.
Yeah, absolutely. It sort of feels that way with every job, because you are like, you're readjusting everything about yourself creatively to fit for this new job. But absolutely, there's an excitement that you can't reproduce when you're just learning everything, when it's all new, and when it's like, Cartoon Network has a pancake machine. Like, that's exciting at first.
Yeah.
But then after your 100th pancake, you're like, it's a pretty good pancake for something that's made by a metal box with a conveyor belt in it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but when it's exciting, when it's new, it's great. Yeah. I miss the pancake machine.
That's so funny. Yeah. I don't know if they still have it anymore, because that building is not theirs anymore now. It's all in the same one building. But
yeah. Yeah, I don't know what they did with the pancake machine. I have a feeling they probably sold it or trashed it. But
Yeah.
It's probably better that I didn't try to buy it.
I kind of want to get into this question from someone on Instagram, Ask Paint Sponges. What is your favorite thing about being a storyboard artist? And what's something unexpected you learned after you first started getting work as a board artist?
My favorite thing is feeling like I have a real influence on the finished product. There's board driven and there's script driven. I prefer script driven now because board driven is a lot of work. We have to write it as well. And sometimes that's writing on the spot, and that's really hard. But the ego does love the opportunity to really put your stamp on the story in such a big way when it's like a board driven, when it's a board driven show. But yeah, I like the opportunity to really make a difference in terms of the actual story, and feel like when I see the final thing, I'm really seeing myself on the screen, especially if it's, you know, like a more personal episode of something that feels like you're really personally invested in making sure it's great. So I love that. I love, again, it's that human element. I love being able to add myself to something. And thing I didn't expect, I mean, kind of everything. It always looks so easy when you see other people do it, right?
But it's
so hard. Like, nobody can draw for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, nonstop. Mm-hmm. If we could, we'd all be able to finish our board in 2 weeks or 1 week. But like, it's just a whole lot of starting and stopping. It's a whole lot of thinking and toiling. And I guess I didn't expect that. I've learned to accept it. That's okay. Sometimes it's not going to be easy. Rarely is it easy. But yeah, I guess I expected it to be a little more effortless, and I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, I think it's the thing that's a little bit deceiving when you see a storyboard online and you're like, oh, well, these are rough drawings. This is really fast to draw, right? But then it's like, there's just so many drawings, and, you know.
There's a lot of them, and there's more to it than just drawing, you know? Like, you know, even if you're doing a script-driven show where you don't have to write it, you still have to think a lot about shot compositions and acting and expressions and just, like, making sure you've laid down a grid that feels appropriate for a background artist to work from or makes sense for the shot. I don't know. It's just, there's so much to it. It truly is like everything in the kitchen sink, and that keeps it exciting, but it can be really stressful. Not to discourage anybody. I mean, like, when it's great, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I think it's like, I like that you're describing that all of these different skills all together amount to a lot of brain power, because boards can look kind of deceivingly easy. And I like, I don't know, that's my little soapbox moment. People who listen to all the episodes in a row, they know that I have my little moment where I'm like, boards are hard. but
it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, yeah, like you said, it's not to discourage anybody. It's just to kind of give ourselves a little pat on the back.
Well, and the other thing that is difficult, that's a little misleading, is that the boards that we see online are almost always, we have like a confirmation bias because we're looking at boards from artists that we love, whose work we love, who are doing these sort of next level boards. Those are the likeliest ones to be shared as our best work. Yeah. But you know, not every panel, not every shot is going to look great. Like it's going to be functional. It's going to communicate, which is really, you know, the most important part, but like the prettiest stuff is what you see online. Mm-hmm. so I think I'm still in this mode where I have to remind myself, like, not every drawing has to be pretty. It's not about that. I guess that's something that I would say I learned and was really valuable, and I'm still working on, because you know, my boards are really clean, mm-hmm, typically, and I don't consider that a plus. I think it's nice, but it's like it takes so much longer.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't know, don't be fooled by what you see online. Like every artist whose work you love, like, they have ugly boards too. They just don't show them.
Yeah, that's so true. There is a moment on a production when you're like, are on an episode and you're like, oh, this is actually a really cool episode, I'm just gonna give it 100% just because then I know I can kind of like use it for my portfolio. But yeah, that's just, yeah, it's definitely not every episode. That's so, yeah, that's a really interesting observation here. Do you feel like you're really clean in your boards because you come from comics?
I think I'm really clean in my boards because I do a lot of illustration and comics to some degree, yeah. But I don't know how to draw K. Rool. I'm sorry, Gabe. this isn't going well. I know Gabe. He'll be fine.
He'll be fine with it.
I'll draw him a good one later. I'll draw him a good one later. It's fine.
You can look up references if you want. It doesn't have to.
That's the problem. Is I'm looking at references, and it's bad. It's not good. It's fine. I'll try again.
If you're listening on Spotify, anybody, make sure you check out the YouTube video so you can, and then you can comment if you like the drawing. No.
you can. You know, it's fine if you don't. Not every drawing is going to be great. What is the old Steven Universe saying? If I can be so glib, if every pork chop were perfect, we wouldn't have hot dogs. Haha.
That's really cute. Yeah,
it is really cute.
They have some really good lines in that they show. Did, yeah. I kind of wanted to add, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned illustrations, because I remember definitely feeling that way when I was mostly boarding in the beginning of my career, and I didn't really have a lot of time to work on personal stuff. And there was a moment when I was like, I feel like I'm never finishing any drawing, and I feel like I'm never doing anything finished. Yeah. And sometimes I feel like if you're someone who comes from more like comics or illustration, that can start kind of like weighing on you a little bit, just because it's like, I just want to see a finished drawing. I just want to make it, you know?
Yeah. It's always wild to me when I see artists who color their boards and stuff, but on some level I get it, mm-hmm, because like, or people who do a lot of like really fancy grayscale shading and stuff, I understand that desire to see this thing feel finished. Mm-hmm. And it is finished. It's finished when it communicates what it needs to communicate, right?
Yeah.
But you know, we're really bad at knowing when that is because we are all obsessed with making pretty things, and I don't know, it's okay if it's ugly. I don't know, not every board is gonna look good, not every board is going to look good, but
yeah, because
a good board will communicate.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you're building the blueprints for an episode, so you're not trying to finish the episode all by yourself. That's why there's like a whole team.
Yeah I like to consider a storyboard like a conversation with everybody that has to touch it after you. Mm-hmm. And like in my head when I'm boarding, I think, well, what is this going to look like? Like, what is this? Oh, that's a good K roll. that's how you draw K roll. Yeah. What is this going to look like to the people who need to use it for reference, for design, for backgrounds, for, you know, for animation, for timing, for any of it, like everything is, it's a conversation. And I don't know, I when I think of it that way, I try to think like, it's okay if this drawing is not great because the person who's going to be handling it for this purpose is going to know what to do with it.
Yeah that's so true. Yeah. And also because we have like so much to think about too when doing boards, where a lot of time we don't have designs for like pre-design for when we start an episode. So we have to kind of like come up with a rough layout for a lot of the backgrounds. We have to come up with a rough design for characters that haven't been designed. And so
Yeah.
ideally, we maybe, I mean, depending on the show, like not giving too many details on that character kind of leaves a little bit of room for design to kind of like go nuts with it, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really healthy way to look at it. I think sometimes in those situations we think, "Oh, how can I make this design really nice because I want to put my stamp on this part of the process," but it's like you want it to be fun to draw, you want it to be to look good and communicative, but like ultimately it's the designer's job to take that idea and turn it into something that really works for the show, and it's not all about you. And I don't know, like that's the beauty of working on a team. Like it's not all about you. But you know, artists are really bad at knowing that. So and that's okay.
I think that's also part of what you learn on the job. I feel like learning soft skills and learning how to kind of integrate in a team and how to communicate efficiently too between with your supervisor and your peers.
Yeah. It's, you know what? It's like any good relationship, it's all about communication, right? So, yeah.
So you've worked on, so we were talking about how you worked on Craig of the Creek, and we have a you worked on on a lot of shows, but we have somebody who asks, so Gerardo Peter asks, I'd love to know what it was like working on Battle Kitty. Did the interactive nature of the series change the workflow or pipeline at all?
So, yes, I think it slowed us down a lot because we had to. I think, how do I put this? I think there was a lot more red tape because we had to think about the ways in which the show was interactive, and we were all boarding. I mean, there were the main episodes, and then there were shorts, and then there were like really small shorts. So we were constantly sort of bouncing around what kinds of stories we were telling and how long those stories were. And the schedule was a little uncomfortable for that reason, just in terms of like you never really felt like you set into a rhythm. But most of the interactive elements, that was like a lot of that was kind of out of our hands as board artists. We had to think about it on some level, but it was really more that was kind of being wrangled by other people. The map stuff was like it's incredible, it's so cute. But yeah, the interactive elements, they were kind of out of our hands. We had to keep them in mind, but they were not ultimately our responsibility. Matt Leisel was the creator and showrunner on that, and he's another one of those people who like has an amazing idea in his head, and it's sometimes hard to match that. But I would say I learned a lot about being funny working on that show and working under him. But not only that, even though it was stressful because we were all making a lot of work in a short amount of time, I always really appreciated how graceful Matt was. He was always very kind and very understanding to the pressures of working on a really interesting new concept for Netflix, who was only just starting to do in-house animated stuff at the time. So yeah, I would say the biggest takeaway from that job was that I made some incredible friends, and we made an incredible show, and I learned a lot about empathy, and I consider it an extremely valuable experience, and I think it's the funniest thing I've ever gotten to work on. It's great.
Yeah, and it looks so good. And was it your first show working in the CG?
Yeah, but you know, we boarded it like a 2D show.
Nice.
Yeah, it was. I don't really know a lot about boarding specifically for 3D for CG. We boarded it very much like I would board anything else.
Oh, interesting. You didn't have like any kind of like specific roles that were like specific to CG. I know like usually some of the stuff they're like, oh, avoid characters touching each other because it's really hard to animate like stuff like that.
We definitely had rules about like characters interacting with each other in certain ways and how we would have the characters emote and express, because the models, they're meant to look sort of rigid and toy-like. There were certainly rules, but any show has rules that you kind of have to stick to when drawing it. But yeah, there were no like, I mean, we had to be, we had a little more freedom with camera movements and stuff, But I've never been a big fan of like big fancy camera movements, so mm-hmm. I would consider that something I wish I had taken advantage of a little more on the show, was being a little more brave with that. But but yeah, it was very much like boarding anything in 2D. It was shockingly close.
Oh, yeah. So in terms of timeline, I know we're jumping around a little bit here, but you also worked on the Steven Universe.
It did. I worked on Future, the final season.
Mm, was that after or before Battle Kitty?
That was before. I worked on Magiswords and then Craig for two episodes, mm-hmm. or one or two episodes. I can't remember. Two. It was two episodes. And then I jumped over to Steven for 6 months for Future and jumped back to Craig for one or two episodes more, and then to Battle Kitty.
Oh wow, yeah. So you were at Cartoon Network a bunch before you moved to Netflix. Yeah.
Netflix was my second studio.
Oh wow. Puzzled One from Patreon is asking if you learn anything in particular from working on Steven Universe that you think has made you a better artist and writer.
Yeah, Steven Universe was. You know how, like, growing up, you have desires to work on specific things or to make specific things that you love, mm-hmm. that you're a fan of? And I've never really been that person, but Steven Universe was my Spider-Man. You know, mm-hmm. it was my thing that I wanted to make. And I'm really glad I got to do it. I learned a lot about balancing mental health with work on that show because I was unmedicated mm-hmm. for my anxiety at the time, if I remember correctly. And I was just not ready for that job. Mm. I was too green. I was working with, and I value that experience. I really do. I love that I got to do it. I love some of the work I did. I would go back and do that job if I could. That's the only one I would come back and do. But I learned a lot about advocating for yourself. I learned a lot about balancing yourself with the job.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot of personal things doing that job. I don't want to sound negative. It was like a really formative experience for me, but it just was one that I wasn't quite ready for, you know? And I don't know. I mean, I will say, like, from a practical perspective, I learned a lot from the supervisors and directors about how to be a better board artist. Mm-hmm. These are things that I wish I had known going into the job, mm-hmm. but you know, we can't change that. So
yeah, and I feel like Steven was like a very hard show to work on from whatever, not in a negative way, but it's just like you needed like it's like a show that asked for a lot of skills. Like not only did you need to be like a good writer, but you need to like know all the storyboarding. And I think that experience of kind of like working on Future, which was a pretty new crew compared to the very original seasons, had like a lot of people who were really excited to work on their favorite IP, and I think that can be kind of tough because it's kind of hard to find the boundary between like yourself and the work.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure when you feel like when you're part of making something good that you have always felt was incredible and you don't know if you can match that level. And that's just too much pressure to put on yourself, mm-hmm. you know? Nobody should feel that way about about the things they do, you know, about their job, about anything, really. I don't know, like, yeah, it was a lesson in being kind to myself. Mm-hmm. Accepting that, like, sometimes you can love something too much. Yeah. Like, it's really complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Again, I have many positive feelings about my experience on Steven. I'm not here to make it sound like it was a bad time. It was just a very, you know, it was just very tricky. And a lot of us cared a lot, maybe a little too much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally relate to that. I feel like there's a moment when, because the thing is that like you're quote unquote just a board artist. So there are moments when some of the decision making anyhow is going to be made up top. So you have control, but you don't have like either like 100% control. So it's like sometimes it's good to kind of like step back a little bit just to give back that control to like supervisors or other team members, I guess, if that
Yeah.
Make any sense for anybody listening.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes sense for me. That is definitely something I learned as well. Is like, so I would say largely because of Steven Universe, a lot of younger board artists at the time, including myself, younger slash newer, went into the job of boarding thinking like, oh, I'm a hotshot. Like I'm a board artist. Board artists are like online, they're internet famous on Tumblr. Like
Yeah.
we all go into that with that mindset. But like once you're there, and this was true on Magiswords, this was true on Craig, but like you have influence on the thing, but again, you're part of the process, you're not the process. And there were times on Steven where like ideas, I mean, Rebecca, to her credit, has always been really she was amazing to work with. She loves hearing everybody's perspective, and I think that's really cool. But at the end of the day, you have to learn to hear no. Like you just have to learn, like, hey, your idea, it's maybe not that your idea is bad. Sometimes your idea is bad, but you have to learn to say no. It's throwing eggs at a wall. Like it's good to get the ideas out, but it's good to hear no. It's good to know when no is good.
Yeah, and it's also kind of like that thing that's a little tricky too when you're working on a board-driven show versus a script-driven show is that like on a board-driven show you're a little bit like in a writer's room and that's like a whole new set of skills that you need to learn in terms of like knowing when to pick up what the showrunner and or like head of story is asking for in terms of like sometimes it can be kind of subtle, but like you said, like if you're like pitch an idea once or twice and they're like, that's interesting, but and then it's like, oh, okay, that means no.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to the credit of the higher up positions, the higher up creatives on Steven, they were always pretty good about being able to say, this doesn't work, this isn't what we need. And I, there were times where it was really hard to hear, especially if you put a lot of effort into an idea. But yeah, I mean, it's the right thing. Most of the time, I felt like, looking back, I was like, okay, they were right. That's fine. Yeah, like this job, for anybody that's looking to get into storyboarding, I'm not gonna sit here and be like, I'm an old millennial and you have to have a thick skin. It's not that. It's more that you have to like appreciate that as part of the process, taking notes and taking feedback. It's not personal and it's healthy, and sometimes it is hard. It's still hard. Even 8 years in, it's hard. But like it's also nice to know that the fact that they're giving you notes means you're not alone. Like you have, if you have people in leadership positions who are good at what they're doing, they will know that you are doing your best, and they will be cognizant and empathetic and sympathetic to that. I've definitely worked with some people who I think just really enjoyed being right, but a good director or supervisor knows that you're trying your hardest and is patient with you and is there to help you. And getting notes, it's hard, but it is good for you, and that's a big part of the job.
Yeah, and it's also like a way to show that they care. I feel like there's always a moment, like if you stop getting notes, it's kind of like, oops. It's kind of, it might be like a scary indicator.
Yeah, you can definitely tell, like, sometimes you didn't get a lot of notes because you really knocked it out of the park. And sometimes you didn't get a lot of notes because they're just like, I don't know what to do with this man. And we've all been there. It's okay, but yeah, it's a thing that you kind of know in the room.
Yeah, that I feel like that. That's so like it's funny because it's we could talk about it, but then at the end of the day, I feel like you kind of have to experience it to kind of really like understand like the depth of it. At least for me, that's kind of how I felt like coming here in the US and experiencing the way the productions work is kind of like, oh, you do kind of have to like go through the ringer a couple of times to be like, oh, okay, that's what this means or this is kind of how this works.
It's broken eggs making an omelet. Like your first episode, maybe your first two, they're always going to be a little weird and wonky because you're learning how to make a show. Like, if the people in charge are not empathetic and sympathetic to that, that is a failing on their part. But you're gonna break some eggs. It's okay. And you and like any skill, learning to take notes and to take critiques, it just takes time, and you just have to hear it a lot.
Yeah, that's true too. The hearing it a lot part is like sometimes we're like, I've mastered this, and then it's like, oh, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, there are times in life where, or in work, where you're just like, I can't get this note anymore. But it's like, you know, sometimes you just need to realize why you keep getting that note. Like, sometimes it's just something you need to think about. But I don't know, we're all doing our best.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we have a lot of awesome questions too, that are, I'm going to try to kind of lump them into like a similar type of theme. And I think we're going to go into your prime time, more kind of like realm of experience,
sure,
with at Chivistian One, who asked, what is the experience like coming from kids animation to adult primetime animation in terms of boarding, writing, and dealing with SNP notes? People love the SNP stories.
I think because people are afraid of getting those notes. and they can be really frustrating. My experience in kids media is that you do have a lot more influence on the final thing. In my experience, this isn't necessarily true across the board, but adult primetime tends to be a little more writer-driven. Mm-hmm. That's different from script-driven. It's where the, or I guess it's script-driven, but, you know, typically, in my experience, it's a lot more sort of driven completely by what the writers want and put on the page, and you can't really change it. A lot of the time, you're even working with stuff that's already been recorded by actors.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's not... Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not as common with kids media. So, yeah, I have found that working in adult primetime, it's more like just doing the job and trying to do it well, and less about making a lot of really deep creative decisions. And there's nothing wrong with just wanting to do the job and do it well. Mm-hmm. My Isabel's looking a little goofy here. I'm going to try her again. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's just kind of putting your head down and taking notes and not pushing back too much, because there's not a lot of wiggle room. It really is about what's already on the page. And do I prefer it? No, I don't. But but it's a job, and sometimes what I need is a job that's a job, and not this big grand creative thing. Sometimes that's just what life calls for.
Yeah, and I think that can also be very useful between balancing personal and professional art, like at least, like from my experience, I feel like when you can take a little bit of a step back from the day job, because there's like a lot of stuff that's been figured out for you in terms of like style and story and all that, then you have a little bit more brain space. And I think that's kind of like a good way to jump into your personal art.
Yay!
Ninja Panda 393 is asking, are your favorite things to design? So I'm going to ask specifically for your personal art.
Sure. So anybody who's aware of me knows that most of my personal art is pinups of men with larger bodies, which is a very sort of dry way to put it. But I love the human form of all genders, but I like specifically focus on male bodies. I am a queer person. I feel like more art that expresses queer joy is something that I think we all kind of need right now as queer people in a very divisive world, and that's something that I like to contribute to. I also just love things that are campy. I love anything with like a wink and a nod, and it's really, I think also it's wildly different from what I would draw if I'm working in kids media. So it's easy to separate that from work. And yeah, that's, I don't know. I just love the human form. I think we're really beautiful machines.
Yeah, that's so.
Yeah.
And I think you have a very cute way to like do your drawings. They're both anatomically correct, but also very cute. You have like a very like kind of round type of design, which is really pleasing to look.
Oh, thank you.
And I think we had a question. Yeah, so I can kind of jump into Steph Static's art on Instagram is asking like, what was your process for developing your style and what influences led you to the current look and feel of your work?
Sure. I would say my biggest influence has to be all of those video game manuals I copied from as a kid. Like I'm blanking on the artist's name right now, but if you look at the old Super Mario Brothers artwork, it doesn't look like anything out there. It's these perfectly clean lines and these like beautiful airbrush highlights, and it's still unmatched. And they still have that style as like one of their sort of house styles over at Nintendo for Mario and Donkey Kong and Yoshi related things. And I just love a big, fat, bold line, and I guess I've loved that ever since I was a kid. So yeah, I love that. I'm a little anime deficient, unfortunately, but I do love the style of like 80s and 90s anime as like a stylistic influence. It's something that I need to actually get more familiar with so that I can talk to more of my friends about stuff for a change. Because everybody knows so much about anime, and I'm like, I get the basic references, but I lack the nuance. So yeah, I just love anything that feels bold and bright. I love, clean lines. And, working in animation for so long, I mean, in animation and comics, I don't know, I've always just favored designs that are easier and more manageable, and my stuff, maybe it doesn't look very hard to draw because I like to keep it simple. Yeah, I don't know. Simplicity. I love simplicity. So learning through the years doing storyboards and working in animation and appreciating cartoons, I've learned a lot about how I can cut corners without sacrificing quality. Yeah, I would say my professional work is a big influence on my personal work in that way.
Oh, yeah.
Always thinking about ways I can make it feel streamlined.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's funny that you mentioned that because I felt a little bit like almost like there's like a little brush of like anime influence in your work, but now that you mentioned the Nintendo, I'm like, oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, what is Nintendo but anime, right? Like, just a different one than what I think, like, most than what your mom thinks of when she thinks of anime. Like, but yeah, I just love cute things, and Nintendo has always been really good at that. And yeah, I'd say that's like Nintendo as an extension of anime is like kind of my influence. Or, Doraemon, Astro Boy slash Mighty Atom, like those are two perfect designs in my opinion. Like, yeah, I just love cute and simple stuff and stuff that's bright and poppy and colorful. And it's funny, as a teenager, I was like all about Invader Zim, and I wanted so bad to be goth, but I wasn't cool enough. And then I just accepted that I'm gay, and also I love bright colors, and it changed my life. So,
That's
yeah.
so funny because I kind of like relate to that in the sense of like being like wanting to be like cool so bad because there's a little bit of like the Invader Zim kind of vibe that is kind of very cool and edgy, and then you have to come to terms like maybe I'm not edgy, maybe I'm just
Well, I think when you're a teenager, I think you miss out on the things that make Invader Zim smart, and you focus instead on the things that make it really quotable and memeable. And like, when you want to feel bad because it's fun to feel bad when you're a teenager on some level, like when you want to be edgy and moody, like it's easy to latch on to those aspects of that show, but I still think there's a lot of value in Invader Zim. Not that we're saying there isn't. I mean, I think there's a lot of value in goth culture too. Like, not I don't want to devalue anybody's
Oh, I still
thing,
love
but
emo and goth culture so much. Like I
yeah.
it's a weird thing because I feel like I've never been like 100% in it, but I was kind of like adjacent to it, and they're definitely my
Right.
favorite characters to design. I still love nowadays to like look up goth fashion or like emo and scene fashion. It's like I don't know, because for some reason like the big hair, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like J-Rock or like
Absolutely.
Like, if you like played Final Fantasy, you're probably really into scene as well. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like, also, this has always been true. Where there's goth kids, there's probably anime. Like, if you were friends with the anime girls or the goth kids, like if you were friends with the nerdy girls in high school or the goth kids, they were all watching anime, they were all playing video games. Like, goth kids are just nerds that are too cool to admit it. And I say that lovingly. I wanted so badly to be that cool, but instead I was just a nerd. And that's okay. I turned out okay. But yeah, those things have always kind of existed together, and I think that's beautiful.
It is both very campy though. I feel like I think that all gravitates around camp, right? Like the nerd culture, goths, anime, all of that is very I don't know exactly like in the way kind of like dramatic.
Yeah, it takes a lot of self-awareness to pull any of that off correctly. Like the ways that goth culture is funny, the way anytime anybody's funny, it's usually a self-aware thing. I don't know. I think it's all really funny is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. But it all feels related. It all feels like none of it exists without each other. Goth culture and anime nerds. It's great. It's beautiful. Now I want to like make a goth pinup. I've never really done
Yeah,
that.
I was just thinking about it.
You've
Oh,
inspired me.
yeah, I'm like, ooh, I can't wait to see it. You have to sketch it on
Oh my
the show.
gosh.
It happened here first, everybody, the inception of the
Let's see. Let me think. Well, I've got my beautiful Isabel.
Yeah, that's a great. She's so
She's.
cute. That's like the perfect. I was trying to do that, like Animal Crossing and like Sailor Scout, and I was like, I can't figure it out, and this is perfect.
It's a great prompt. It's really good. I think I gave her a foxtail, but you know what? When she's Sailor Moon, she can be a fox dog. What are foxes but cats and dogs that have become one?
Right? Oh, they're so cute. I recently, well, as a, you know, when you're like trying to like react to someone's comment with a GIF, you go into the little like Giphy, and I typed in zoomies, and like a GIF of a fennec popped up, and I was like, oh, that is like the perfect symbiosis between a cat and a dog, you know?
It really is, yeah.
They're like small cat-like personality, but also they're like a little dog. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they'll eat other animals, but also they make cute noises, and I'm here for it.
Yeah.
I don't
I realize that we have some other like really great questions about like still working on shows, so we're gonna like hop back into the animation industry conversation with this Twitter question from
Sure.
at Eggwords, who asks, is it harder to board on a new show or one that's already been established when you join?
That's a really good question. I kind of feel like they both have their ups and downs. I actually really prefer to work on a new show because it's that thing of feeling like you're contributing to the tone and the direction of something. Whereas like coming in on a show that's really established, I mean if it's one season in, it's a little easier because you feel like they've worked out a lot of the kinks. But if it's, you know, in the case of Steven, I think Future was technically like season six. You're coming in and you're joining a group of people who are speaking a whole different language, and you have to learn it on the spot. So if it's like a long running series, and I haven't jumped into too many of those, but if it is, that comes with some really unique challenges. I think I personally prefer coming in on something new though, or something that's one season in.
Yeah, because then you get to like figure it out with the rest of the crew. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. It is a little daunting to like think about coming onto a show that's like in season like 5 or 6. Like, for example, I don't know if you like were to jump onto like Rick and Morty and you're like, oh, it's like kind of already like got so many seasons and you have to like learn the style of the show.
Yeah, and you know, like usually the reason that you are there is because you proved on some level that you're able to fit in with that. But it is, you know, it's challenging no matter what.
We have some questions about Your favorite, so Joe Benson, our patron, is asking, what is your favorite A24 movie besides the series you've worked on?
First of all, number one, Happy Family USA, the series that I worked on. It's a really unique project. It's really funny. Look forward to it. I don't want to say too much because I don't know how much I can or should say, but it's cool. After giving it some thought, I think Everything Everywhere All at Once is one of the best movies I've seen in the past decade. And it's such an easy answer. Like, everybody loves that movie. It's so clever. It's got that amazing action, but it's also got that incredible human element. It's also really campy, but in the best way. I also really like Midsommar, or Midsommar, however you want to pronounce it. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I think it's a really interesting one. And sometimes that's better than, I think that's better than perfect. And it's hard to watch. Like, when I first saw it, I think we double featured that and whatever Spider-Man movie came out at the time. And I remember watching, I think we watched it after Spider-Man, maybe before, but I remember afterwards, my eyes felt deep fried. It's such a bright movie.
Oh,
Like,
Midsummer?
it just, yeah, it's
Yeah,
so
that's
bright.
true. I forgot. I watched it on TV, so I don't have like the movie experience, but because of because of like the trippy sequences and stuff.
Yeah, it's just, it all takes place in, a place where there's not really nighttime. And so, yeah, if you see it in theaters, your eyes are just like, what have you done to me for the past 2.5 hours? It's rough, but it's a good movie. I think it's good in so many ways. It's a really interesting take on horror. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have seen it, but if you haven't, and if you have the stomach for, weird Swedish death cults in the daylight, there's your movie.
There's your movie.
Yeah, there's your Saturday night.
I wonder which one I like left more of an impression on me. If it was, is it the same guy who did The Witch? No.
No, he did
He did
Hereditary.
Hereditary. Yeah, because I.
And Beau is Afraid.
Yeah. Oh, that's him too. Okay, I do need to
Yeah.
watch Beau Is Afraid. I did really like Hereditary. I don't know if I like Midsommar or Hereditary more. I feel like I like that there's the family element in Hereditary.
Right, right. Yeah, Midsommar is more, it's a breakup story, but not a very happy one. But if you'll believe it, I've never seen Hereditary and I need to watch it.
Yeah, it's also kind of it's also freaky, but I think I also liked it because there's a little bit less of the very like gruesome imagery. Like, I mean, it's still there's still some pretty gruesome stuff, but it's for me, I don't know, the people jumping off the cliff and
Oof,
like having the whole thing of that was that's very. I mean, I know that's what they were going for. They want you to feel queasy and like, ooh, yikes. But it is also very hard to watch.
Yeah, I mean, hey, it worked.
It worked, exactly.
But I agree with you. It is hard to watch. And there are moments in that film where I'm just like, make sure you didn't eat recently. Like, it's yucky. But it's smart. It's a smart movie. And Florence Pugh, I mean, come on. None of us can compare to Florence Pugh. She's amazing.
I think we have some like fun little questions. Like I'll just give a quick shout out to well, I guess we already answered a question from Nothlet Casey L5734. Thank you for all your other questions, but I want to get to at Zinth Stars on YouTube who asked, do you prefer communicating stories visually or through writing?
Visually, I find it really, really hard to send just a written thing to somebody because I feel like visually, so okay, I'm not good at brevity. I'm really wordy, and one of the things I like about communicating with art and with visual art, I should say, is that I get to say a lot in a shorter, in what feels like a shorter space. Whereas if I'm writing something, I'm going to tell you every stupid detail, things you don't even need to know. And I just feel like I'm wasting my time if I'm just sending somebody a written thing. I can write a script or a comic script, cartoon or comic script, in a way that communicates well to other people. But in general, if I have the time and the energy to put at least some visual element on there just to make sure we're like meeting in the same place, I will. That's what I prefer to do.
Yeah, I feel that. I feel like I don't know if you also relate to this, but I feel like sometimes just drawing a scene is, or even just a picture tells so much more than what we could do with words. I don't know. I feel like prose is so hard. Like I've tried to write prose and I'm like, I don't know. This is like, you know, there's like such a specific way of layering elements to translate a feeling or like an atmosphere without being too verbose, right?
Yeah, I agree. There's just so much going on in our heads, you know. It's nice to be able to say, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas writing, it, to me, writing always, in my process, always feels like a blueprint. It always feels like a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like, visual things can be plans too, but I don't know. I like not wasting people's time, and I feel like my writing wastes people's time.
That's funny.
Maybe I should appreciate my writing skills a little more. I don't know.
There's something that we were talking prior to recording that I kind of want to get into a little bit, where
sure.
We were talking a little bit about how, yeah, like, because of the nature of your personal art, which can be kind of intimate, the people can feel like they can be sort of to kind of skip a boundary line maybe with you as an artist. And how do you kind of handle that?
I might have said this previously while recording, but I do try to give people the benefit of the doubt. I think most people mean well.
Mm-hmm.
If people cross a certain boundary, I'm happy to use the block button, which I think is something being creatives online that share our work, regardless of the content of it, we should all be comfortable with the block button.
Mm-hmm.
But it is tough because, so just to get personal for a second,
mm-hmm.
my boyfriend and I, we're in an open relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So we have boundaries, we have rules about that, but there's some openness in like how we interact with other people in a flirty or potentially sexual way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some people who know that think that it's okay to cross the boundaries even further than they should. And I guess I would say the best thing you can do in any situation is always do your due diligence to get a feel for how somebody feels about you or how a question sounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. It's I understand on some level why people feel like they can cross that boundary. I understand how sometimes people may think that my work is consent, but my work is not consent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My words and my actions are when I'm interacting with you individually, but my work is not.
Mm-hmm.
That said, like, if people are just like giving a compliment to me or whatever, like, I'm used to it, it's fine. I'm not gonna sit here and tell you like I'm 10 out of 10 hot mama or whatever, but like I appreciate a compliment. I'm human, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when people get creepy or weird, you know, that's when I'm likelier to use the block button than say something these days, because I don't like arguing with people on the internet or making things weird.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, I just use the block button if you need to.
No, I like to talk about those kind of stuff because I do feel like as artists, we have to kind of have a little bit of a public facing persona just to share our art. And even as an artist, if you want to do commissions, it's almost impossible if you don't have like an internet presence and you want to kind of show the kind of work that you would want to be commissioned for. And I think that those are kind of really interesting things to think about how you can manage your community, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and it's really tough because for a very long time, for, you know, 15 years now, as denizens of the internet, we've all sort of accepted that in order to be successful, you also have to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that drawing boundaries is really hard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it gets easier the older you get, the more experienced you get. But it's really hard. It's really hard to know, like, when somebody has crossed a boundary.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to know how to prevent that and how to deal with it when it happens. But, like, we've all been told, like, hey, you know, you're not just a person, or you're not just an artist, you're a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either create a fake version of yourself, and that's fine, I guess. Or you can be yourself and deal with some of the pitfalls that come with being yourself online.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Sometimes it's like not always the best advice to make yourself your quote unquote brand, you know?
Yeah.
I sort of respect people who are like, I like to put my name on my work,
mm-hmm.
all of my work. I've never had a pseudonym for my work, even my pinups work. I've always been very proud of
mm-hmm.
it. But I get it. I get it when people are like, oh, my name is, you know, Flower Pot or whatever. Like, it's, I get it. It's you want to separate your online presence from your real life. I mean, quote unquote, real life. I think our work is our real life too, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah. It's like your personal identity versus the online brand, like separating the two and making it a little harder to find, I guess.
Yeah. yeah, that's a really good way to put
that's, it. It's something that is kind of tricky because, like you, I decided kind of early on to put my name everywhere because I'm like, okay, well, if somebody likes my, I don't know, comic or illustration, I just don't want to make it harder for them to find me in case there could be like a potential interesting business opportunity. But yeah, then it does link all the different aspects of yourself to your professional persona. And have you ever had any moment when working for a studio, you felt like you had to be more careful using your online, your socials, you know what I mean? Like sometimes I feel like, because in the contract, sometimes I feel like we kind of have to, I don't know, I forget exactly the language of how the contracts are drafted, but we can easily be associated with the studio, even though it's just us.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. Also, Pearl's forehead isn't that big, but whatever, we're going with it. I think that's a really great question. So I know there are like rules around drawing the characters that you draw professionally in certain situations that are frowned upon. Like you don't, I mean, well, now you can draw Mickey Mouse however you want to, apparently, but
the Steamboat Willie one, not Mickey Mouse. That's so funny.
Yeah, he can be sexy, but only if he's in black and white. No, it's tricky. Like you can get in trouble if you're like drawing, yeah, sexy Donald Duck or whatever. Like if you're into that, that's cool. But so I've never, and I don't do a ton of fan art anyway. And I'm not one of those people that's constantly drawing the stuff that I'm drawing for work at home. I think it's really cool when artists are having that kind of fun, but I'm like, I have naked men to draw, so I'm busy. I know that's frowned upon, but I've personally never run into any pushback on my personal work. And the way I see it is I wouldn't want to work for a company that would have that much control over what I can do outside of work hours. Mm-hmm. You know, frankly, I don't care who I'm working for. It's none of their business what I'm doing in my free time, short of, you know, horrible crimes. You know, I really think it's important to be able to express yourself freely as a creative outside of the job. So if I had that issue, I don't know that I'd want to stick around.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's so tied to what I do in my personal work now that it would be kind of impossible to separate myself from it. And I think like there are probably some job opportunities maybe I've missed out on or just, you know, creative opportunities in general because of my personal work. But I try to remember that that is true for everybody. Even if they're drawing just, you know, more safe for work stuff, they're doing it in a style that's not going to be right for every job, or they're doing, you know, something tonally that doesn't make sense to convince a recruiter to put you on a certain job or a director or whatever. I just remember, like, we're all doing our own thing on some level, and no matter what you're doing, it's not going to be right for everybody and everything, and that's okay. But yeah, I get asked a lot about, like, the nature of my personal work butting up against my professional work. And it's never, to my knowledge, it's never been a problem.
I love that answer. That's really great because I feel like a lot of people can get very worried about it. And it's like very freeing and nice to hear that.
Yeah. Well, you have to give yourself permission to do what you feel you need to do. And sometimes that is, you know, doing something that doesn't really match up with on paper what you do professionally, and that's okay. I think it's good to have interests and needs outside of work.
Yeah.
whether they're creative or not, like get a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, it's it's good to give yourself permission to be authentic to yourself. That can be hard, but it's important.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that's such a good advice too for like creative health, I think, if I can put it in any better way. Because when drawing has been your personal like little secret garden for so long in your life, and then it becomes your professional career, then it is really tricky to find that balance. And I think that's an answer that's giving like a lot of avenues to explore that and keep that like creative, I don't know, health. I don't know, that's the best way I can be, the best word I can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, we think a lot nowadays about mental health. Mm-hmm. We think about that, and you know, everybody's always had physical health in mind, but creative health is a thing too. You know, being a creatively healthy person is your duty to yourself as a creative professional. And if you need to draw, like I see, you know, artists who work in animation who are outside of work who are doing, you know, beautiful collages or like landscape paintings or whatever, or like are making beautiful music, or they're rock climbing. There's a lot of rock climbers in animation. Like people who are, you know, channeling their energy elsewhere. It's always good for your creative soul.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel like, talk about creativity, let's talk about creative block. Do you experience creative block? And if you do, how do you deal with it?
I do. I don't know an artist who doesn't experience creative block. I am better at getting out of it. It tends not to last longer than a day these days, which is good. I think that's just by virtue of drawing enough. Like, I draw a lot. I draw a lot for work. I draw a lot personally. I always say I don't draw enough, but I think we're all really hard on ourselves. Mm-hmm. But just by virtue of drawing a lot, I think it means that like I'm able to understand that every drawing is a little bit disposable. Mm-hmm. And I think taking the pressure off is really good. If I'm really hitting a block, the first thing I'll do if I'm trying to be creative is I'll like draw on post-it notes, or I'll draw on like a crappy legal pad or something. The crappier the paper, the better, because it means that it feels really disposable and there's no pressure. So like drawing in a way that feels like there's no pressure, that's a really good place to start. But honestly, sometimes being creative is not the best way to try and get through a creative block. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the best thing you can do is, for me, it's usually play a video game or go see a movie. I believe in absorbing other people's output to recharge myself sometimes. Nothing can be made in a vacuum. Sometimes you just need that little inspiration, and sometimes you just need your brain to have a break. Mm-hmm. I know these are all probably really common answers, but yeah, just walking away from your art for a day and just giving yourself, again, it's that thing about permission, like giving yourself permission not to make and just go do something else. That really helps me. It's not perfect. It doesn't work 100% of the time, but it's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great one. It's so hard sometimes to walk away from like a problem that you're trying to solve, but yeah, like finding that moment of like, okay, I'm in a rut. I need to kind of like look at something else for a minute and distract and get inspired, distract myself, get inspired. Yeah. It's such a great answer.
Well, and we also have to acknowledge, like, if you're working on a job, whether that's a comic job or an animation job, or you're just doing a commission or an illustration, which honestly, commissions for me, I'm doing better now, but that's where I hit a lot of blocks. You have to do the job.
Yeah.
Somebody's paying you to do it. So it's tough, because especially if you're on a gig with like a really tight deadline, you can't always just walk away for a day. But if you can like get in your car and go to your local coffee shop and get yourself something nice to drink and treat yourself nice for, you know, a half hour, an hour, just let your brain like rest for a little bit. I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but it helps. Just take the relaxation where you can get it in those situations. I remember on Magiswords especially, Zoe and I would walk to Starbucks probably every day. And it was right down the street from Cartoon Network, but it was just like a good reason to get up and, you know, give our bodies a break from our chairs and just put something sweet in our stupid bodies. I don't know.
Yeah.
It helped. It helped us wake up. It helped us come back and feel like we're ready to tackle the rest of the day. So even little things go a long way.
That's a great answer. Is there anything that you would want to plug?
Yeah, I have been running a Patreon for about a year. It's patreon.com/DrewGreen. And there are a few tiers. I'm trying to treat it more like a sketchbook. I'm trying to do more loose work. But if you want, you can also join the sticker club, the pinup sticker club, where I will mail you a really cute pinup sticker based on a theme voted on by the patrons every month. So check that out. I'm having so much fun with it. It's been really, really cool. And it's a great and relatively inexpensive way to support me.
I love that. Yeah, and I love sticker clubs. I've started a sticker club too for my webcomic, and I think it's so fun to make the little design. Nice. And then every month you get your sticker in the mail and you're like, ooh, merch.
Yeah, people really seem to like getting that physical thing, and everybody's got a water bottle now, so you've got a place for stickers.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, and honestly, some of my favorite designs I've ever done have been the stickers. February will be my year of doing the stickers every month, and I just think they all turned out great and they look real good, you know, in a place where other people can appreciate them, especially if you like a good beefy guy.
So if you've got any room on your laptop, on your sketchbook or water bottle, you know where to get your next sticker.
Yeah. Patreon.com/DrewGreen.
Yes. Well, that's the end of this creative blog, Drew. Thank you so much for being our guest and sharing your story.
Thank you.
And thanks to your listeners. Follow us on social media. It's at Creative Blog, where we ask for drawing prompts and questions to ask your guests. We've had like a lot more questions coming from YouTube. So thanks to all of our YouTube followers. You guys are the best. Huge thanks to our editor, Clemens, for editing the podcast, Marco for helping us produce the show, and Ibuka for creating the short clips we've been putting out. So these are on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube Shorts. If you love our show, you can support us on Patreon. Becoming a patron gets you early access to interviews and access to our Discord community. But a great way for you guys to support us is to just interact with our content. You can comment on this episode or any of our posts, like and subscribe. If you don't know what to write in the comments, you can just tell us what was your favorite thing that you've watched this week. You can see all of Drew's socials in the description of this episode and the link to your Patreon, etc. I have been your host, V. Keep being creative, and we'll see you next week. Bye.